From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Governor Rick Perry gets tough on Texans on public assistance.
Being on drugs makes it harder to begin the journey to independence.
Is this good public policy or just plain politics?
It would be more interesting probably to start drug testing our legislators and see what's going on.
Other states are doing it. Should Texas relax its pot laws?
Every argument just about has ever been used to demonize marijuana has been thoroughly debunked.
And Mexico gets ready for a new president. What will it mean for border violence and the war on drugs? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Here is a new word for your Texas political lexicon, TANF. It's the acronym for Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and it's the Texas equivalent of welfare. Texas is one of the lowest spending states on welfare. The per capita expense for welfare is $32, compared to New York, which is $256. The national average is $99. So Texas is not overly generous when it comes to family assistance, but now things are getting even tougher for TANF families. This week, Governor Rick Perry and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst announced their plan for a new drug testing program for TANF and unemployment benefits. Let's hear about it directly from our two top state leaders. They had a press conference on November the 13th.
I'm calling on the Texas legislature to enact reforms that include authorizing the use of drug screening for TANF and unemployment benefit recipients. In the case of TANF benefits, this will help prevent tax dollars from going into the pockets of drug abusers or drug dealers, and instead ensure this money goes to the people who truly need it. Being on drugs makes it harder to begin the journey to independence, which only assures individuals remain stuck in that terrible cycle of drug abuse and desperation and poverty.
This bill brings the program back to its original mission. The original mission of TANF is to provide temporary assistance to qualified recipients and help them get back on their feet and back to work. This bill institutes screening so that if applicants are deemed to be at high risk, then they're required to be drug tested. And if they test positive, then they're disqualified for the program for up to 12 months.
That was Governor Rick Perry and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst explaining their plan to drug test TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and unemployment benefits. There's little doubt that the drug testing bill will pass and become law, but there are critics of this new proposal, like Jim Harrington, director of the Texas Civil Rights Project.
First set of reasons would be questions of privacy and that we don't invade people's bodies, require drug tests without some sort of cause. This is a principle we have under search and seizure of taking blood or intruding upon a person's integrity. The second reason is a fiscal reason, and it just is totally counterproductive. It doesn't work. We've seen that in the Florida experiment that was in existence for about 4 months. And ultimately, you end up wasting taxpayer money on these drug tests that have no material benefit overall in terms of the program. And in fact, what happens is that you take the money out of these programs to do the drug testing, which means across the board you're denying or lessening the amount of unemployment benefits or the amount of TANF benefits, family benefits, that people would otherwise receive. So it's just done for politics. That's all that it is. You know, it's typical grandstanding that the governor is doing. And I think, unfortunately, it hurts people's lives. And I don't think, unfortunately, again, that much matters to them.
This happened in Florida recently. This was a big thing that happened there. And what did we find out about drug use among people who get public assistance from that instance?
Well, actually, it was about one-third the less of what the drug use was in the general population. And it tended to be basically, you know, some kind of marijuana use. So for all of that money that was put into it, all it did is prove that welfare or unemployment recipients actually have lower level of drug use than the general population. But, you know, and the courts have blocked it, of course. because of constitutional reasons. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, you talk about unemployment benefits, this supports the whole family. Just because a member of the family smokes a little bit of marijuana, which is not unusual these days, that you would deny the family those benefits for the entire, for 6 months. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So how does it work? Do they test everyone in the family or just test one of the parents, or how does that work?
No, it would be the applicant would be the one who's tested. So if you're applying for benefits, let's say for your child, but you tested, you the parent, tested positive for having smoked marijuana, then your child would be denied benefits. What's the point of that? All it does is hurt the kid. What's the point of that?
This has already failed a constitutional test, so therefore this will probably end up in the courts again if this gets passed in the Texas legislature, and it probably will given the leadership and the party affiliation that we have now. So this will be challenged again in the courts in Texas.
Absolutely. And so not only is this demeaning and wasteful program implemented, but then you also have all of the attorney's fees that the state will have to pay both to the Attorney General and I'm sure to the people who bring the lawsuit who will win it. I cannot imagine the courts are going to uphold this.
Yeah, but when I listen to some AM talk radio type stations, the calls come in. Everyone's like cheering this on like it's a good idea. They say, you know, I'm working hard. I don't see why I should pay taxes. And it goes to some guy who sits around and does drugs all day.
See, that is the thing, you know, that there is this myth out there that's totally false, and but it's foisted and perpetuated by the governor, for example. All of the data shows that there is less use of any kind of drugs among people receiving benefits than in the workplace of the guy who called in. You know, that's the thing. You know, we have this demonizing of poor people going on in the country right now. It would be more interesting probably to start drug testing our legislators and see what's going on with them. I mean, if they want to, if we're going to do drug testing in this society, it needs to be across the board for everybody. And I don't think anybody would tolerate that happening under our constitutional principles. And if we wouldn't tolerate it happening for ourselves, why do we tolerate it happening for somebody else? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. But it's part of this political demeaning political rhetoric that's foisted on us these days by our leaders.
Jim Harrington is the director of the Texas Civil Rights Project. He is critical of the Governor Rick Perry proposed law that would require drug testing for Texas welfare or TANF recipients and those getting unemployment benefits. The new Texas anti-drug crackdown was announced just days after two states, Colorado and Washington, passed laws at the ballot box that would allow recreational use of marijuana. Something like that passing in Texas is a pipe dream, according to Josh Schoenberg. He's the executive director of Texas Normal, the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws.
First off, we saw the 18th state to pass legal medical marijuana, that was Massachusetts. Their medical marijuana law was passed on a 2-to-1 margin, which was pretty significant. But the most important news was that Colorado and Washington State both voted pretty firmly to legalize small possession of marijuana for adult usage. They also voted to allow state-run stores and producers to grow and sell marijuana to those adults.
Was this unexpected?
It was not unexpected if you had been following the polls throughout the campaign. Both of those initiatives in Washington and Colorado had been leading in the polls pretty much for the entire campaign. Oregon had a legalization initiative on their ballot. However, their initiative failed to pass, and it had not been leading in the polls in the run-up up to the election.
So while there were some setbacks on election night, mainly there were some major victories. And so what's your opinion about bringing in some loosening of the laws to Texas?
Well, unfortunately, Texas citizens aren't allowed the liberty to have statewide voter ballot initiatives to pass laws in this way. You know, back in 2004, there was a poll done by Scripps Howard statewide poll in Texas that found three-quarters of the respondents in Texas agreed that patients should be allowed to have recommendations for and get medical marijuana if their doctor thought that it would be beneficial. The problem there is there's a huge disconnect between public opinion on this subject, whether it's medical marijuana or decrim or legalization. There's a huge disconnect between public opinion and the legislators, especially in Texas. The legislature has seen over the past several sessions a decriminalization bill that has been authored and introduced by Representative Harold Dutton out of Houston every session, and it's failed to make it out of the House committee that it's been put in. Also, Representative Elliot Neistat from here in Austin has introduced a medical marijuana patient, kind of like a patient protection bill. It calls for an affirmative defense for patients who are caught with marijuana if they have a recommendation. That bill has done even worse in the legislature. It has failed to even really get a hearing.
You're saying that there have been some attempts by a few lawmakers in Texas to get laws passed or even considered, but they just go nowhere because we don't have people-powered politics in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first holdback, really, because vast majority, nearly all of the medical marijuana laws that have been passed in states have been passed through voter ballot initiative. The most famous one, of course, is California's. That was done, you know, back in 1996. And like I said, with the polling that was done in 2004 in Texas, at 75% in support of that question, it's kind of hard to see how Texas would not have already legalized medical marijuana through a voter ballot initiative if that was available to the citizens here.
Well, I mean, here we have states passing these laws. People are able to have recreational marijuana or medical marijuana, which is can be a thinly veiled recreational marijuana use for some folks. How, are we seeing all these nightmare scenarios that these people have predicted, like increase in traffic accidents or reduction in workforce productivity because everyone's high all the time?
No, not at all. And in fact, some of the there's little data on this, really, but some of the studies that have been done out of Colorado and California have shown not only that, but there's not an increase in crime surrounding the medical marijuana dispensaries. There's not a increase in the rate of young people or teenagers using marijuana in these states. And overall, there's not an increase, like you said, of you know, car accidents or anything like this. It's really been a testament to the fact that a lot of the scare tactics that have been used by people to try to keep marijuana as a Schedule I controlled substance, that they've been wrong. And this goes back over the decades, you know, that every argument just about has ever been used to demonize marijuana has been thoroughly debunked.
Josh Schimberg is the executive director of Texas Normal, the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws. He says it's unlikely that Texans will ever have a chance to vote to legalize recreational or medical marijuana. Some select states in the United States aren't alone in rethinking drug laws and the drug war. Mexico is also evolving its policies. And on December 1st, people in Mexico are expecting big changes in their bloody war against the drug cartels. That's when Mexico swears in a new president, Enrique Peña Nieto. But Peña Nieto is bringing with him a bit of old Mexico, the PRI, which is the former dominant ruling party. It's hoped in Mexico that the PRI will turn back the clock when it comes to the battles against the drug cartels. Reporter Lauren Matalon of Marfa Public Radio has just returned from northern Chihuahua, where citizens say they're looking forward to ending Mexico's war on drugs.
The people are friendly and welcoming in the remote village of Manuel Benavides, but everyone's terrified. No one wants to speak. Like much of Chihuahua, like much of Mexico, the truth is elusive, opaque, and silence is the best policy. In December, the old becomes new again. The PRI returns to power after a 12-year absence. The village of Manuel Benavides was once a warehouse for Pablo Acosta, the drug lord who ruled this part of northern Mexico with a brutally iron fist until he was killed by Mexican police. Cartels still are the ultimate power here, their money corroding any semblance of a government by and for the people. People in Manuel Benavides don't like outgoing President Felipe Calderón.
Golpeando y golpeando con firmeza a las organizaciones criminales.
This is Calderón defending his decision to confront the cartels. His choice will be judged by history. Against the backdrop of traumatizing violence fueled by the American appetite for drugs, in places like Manuel Benavides, people expect the PRI will leverage its documented connections to the cartels. Inside a cantina, Norteño music blares, and people are deep in conversation. It's a motley group. Some ranchers, a pair of men who say they've spent time in a U.S. prison, and a fluently bilingual city police officer who looks forward to the PRI's return.
They'll talk to the cartel to see if they could settle or to see what happens.
You think that's a good thing?
Yeah.
I met one man who, like many here, just doesn't trust politicians, but he says when it comes to reducing and managing violence, he thinks the PRI is much better positioned than any other party.
Pienso que va a controlar porque según ellos tienen más experiencia y...
He says the PRI simply has the experience to do what must be done to reduce violence, no matter how odious their purported connections to the cartels might seem from this side of the border. I met with Carlos Castañeda in Mexico City. He's the former Secretary of Foreign Relations who opposed Calderón's decision to go to war.
And he decided to do this, I think, strictly for political reasons, had nothing to do with drugs, nothing to do with violence, nothing to do with corruption. He does not have a definition of victory. What is victory in the war on drugs? No more drugs, drugs going through somewhere else to the United States, fewer drugs, a new modus vivendi with the drug cartels. I don't know what victory is. And thirdly, I don't see the exit strategy. How do you get out of this once you're in it?
An important politician from Chihuahua who'd only speak if I left my recording gear outside told me, after politics is finished, I want to be alive. All I care about is the PRI's ability to speak directly with the cartels. The PRI won't eliminate violence, but they will manage it, he said. Howard Campbell's a security expert at the University of Texas at El Paso.
And the PRI in the past proved very adept at cutting deals with drug cartels and other criminal groups to try to have them stick to their criminal activity but not to commit homicides in public. So I think there is some hope that the violence and homicide rate in Mexico will go down.
Today, the town of Manuel Benavides yearns for the good old bad days when the PRI's political monopoly gave them the power to divide the country into territories and make sure violence was controlled. The political monopoly once enjoyed by the PRI is dead. Mexico is now a multi-party nation. But history speaks, and citizens seem willing to tolerate the potential for corruption if the PRI can leverage its connections to the cartels. I'm Lorne Madelon in northern Chihuahua for Marfa Public Radio.
For almost 10 years, Texas was an independent nation, and there's some sort of talk of trying to make that happen again. Over 100,000 people signed an online White House petition to allow Texas to peacefully secede from the Union. For many of the signers, this was kind of a joke, a way to show their displeasure with the recently reelected President Barack Obama, the gridlock in Washington, D.C., and the ongoing budget deficit battles. But there are those who dream of the day when Texas again takes its place as an independent nation. There is a growing Texas nationalist movement, and David Thomas Roberts is a supporter of Texas independence.
Well, I'm a member of the Texas Nationalist Movement, which is the oldest independence movement in Texas. It has about 250,000 members before the election. It's been growing phenomenally since the election.
I mean, what is it that y'all are trying to achieve?
We want the total political, cultural, and economic independence of Texas.
So a completely separate nation, no connections at all with the Washington, D.C. nation.
Well, let's take it the first step first. The first step is we want to have a referendum put to the people of Texas, and by introducing that into the Texas legislature and letting the people of Texas decide.
But with the end goal of trying to break away from the Union.
Correct.
Now, there was this petition, got a lot of press recently, and on the White House website, asking for allowing Texas to break away from the Union peacefully and form its own government. Was that connected to the Texas Nationalist Movement, or is that something different?
It's something different. Somebody else did that on their own. I mean, we love the attention that it's gotten because it's gotten a lot of attention. Our petition is to the Texas State Legislature. It is our opinion and the constitutional experts that we go to that there's no need for us to go to the president or the White House and ask them for permission for this. So this is a Texas decision. It's not a White House decision.
And you believe that if there was a Texas referendum and people would support it and approve it, then that would be that, and Texas would just go ahead and be an independent country?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of steps. It wouldn't happen quickly. Nobody has any misgivings about that, or we're realists when it comes to that. But the polling that we have done is that by an overwhelming majority, Texans would elect to pursue this course.
An overwhelming majority. Well, I mean, we had the election, recently, and Barack Obama did receive 42% of the vote. That's certainly not great, but it's not, this doesn't show an overwhelming majority of the people who are willing to break away from the country.
Well, sure, but if you flip that and say that the winner won 58% and the loser lost, only won 42%, you would call it a landslide. So, the polling's not going to break exactly like the national election. Well, you'll have some folks that maybe supported Obama that would vote for this, and you may have some that voted for Romney that would not vote for this. But our polling, our internal polling that we've done, places it's well over 50%.
That's assuming that we wouldn't have another civil war to keep Texas from breaking away?
Well, I mean, this is a peaceful movement for us. We are not advocating any type of bloodshed or armed rebellion. I think that you've seen, across the world that peaceful, the will of the people, if they want to be independent, eventually will win out. So part of the referendum is to create the political will for some of the state legislatures to take on this without the fear of reprisals or some kind of political backlash, which is why you've seen Rick Perry flip-flop on this issue in the last 2 years. So once the legislatures and the state politicians, sort of like the Tea Party, when you start to see the groundswell and from the grassroots support it, you'll start to see them changing their tune also.
What is the upside of Texas independence?
For Texas to have its own self-determination and not be not have the centralized government in Washington, D.C. telling Texas how to run its affairs politically, culturally, economically.
Anything else? Anything more than that?
Well, we want our freedom. We want the freedom to be able to operate as an independent country. We want the freedom. We think we have better ideas than Washington, D.C. We think that for the most part, the rest of the country is pulled away from the values and beliefs that Texans have.
Okay, and so how would it work? How would Texas as an independent country work? I mean, there's lots of federal items that would have to be, I guess, given back to Washington, D.C.
Well, I don't know about giving anything back. If Texas has paid taxes to Washington, D.C., so, as far as the details of what would happen, what happens with military bases, what happens with federal highways, what happens with federal buildings, all that has yet to be determined. I mean, again, the ultimate goal is to get this to a referendum first and then start the process. This is not going to be an overnight thing. This is going to take several years to accomplish, and these are the first steps. So all the details, we get asked about the military, about currency, all those type of things, Texans can figure out. I can promise you this. The heroes that were at Washington on the Brazos sitting in that barn while Santa Ana was marching toward them, they didn't have all the answers. They just know they wanted their freedom. The folks in the 13 colonies, they didn't have all the answers of what was going to happen after that. They just wanted their freedom. So we don't have all the answers of what would happen afterwards, but I bet Texans can figure it out.
David Thomas Roberts is a member of the Texas Independence Movement. He's also written the book Patriot of Treason. So does Texas have the legal authority to quit the Union? According to recognized history, government, and constitutional experts, no, it does not. Teresa Van Hoy is a history professor at St. Mary's University in San Antonio.
As for the possibility, the legal possibility of secession, we can offer those of us who study the history of the 19th century the following, and that is that it is not legally possible, that there is nothing in the documents of accession, which is obviously the reverse of secession. The documents of accession don't contemplate the possibility of secession, a subsequent secession. Moreover, as I'm sure folks have by now gleaned, so this is probably nothing new, the U.S. Supreme Court contemplated this matter, and as it came up regarding Texas in 1868, and it was again affirmed that Texas did not have a legal right to secede. And in fact, in that particular case, the Texas versus White case, the legislature was not even obligated to pay back public bonds that had been issued because the secession government wasn't even legal, according to U.S. law. So really, there's no legal grounds that we can find as 19th century historians for this case for secession.
So the bond thing is, when Texas was part of the Confederacy,
it issued bonds,
which was to finance the war and other things. And
exactly right.
And then afterwards, they didn't have to repay those bonds because it was
illegal in the first place to even be, no legislation under secession governments was binding.
So when I talk to these people who want Texas to become an independent country, they say, no, it's a matter of opinion, and we can do it if we want to. If we can figure out a way to make it happen, we will make it happen.
Yeah. Well, this, on the one hand, one can broach the matter. I mean, in the history profession, we prefer not to polarize issues too much, and especially because everything's complex. So what we like to do is say, understand where people are frustrated. We understand where people want to move and reform and change things. But then again, we also have to abide within a legal framework, and there's not one here. Here's something that we could tell our friends who are so robustly, who define secession within the finest tradition of Texas. They think, wait a minute, secession is within the finest tradition of Texas because we were a republic, because we love liberty, because we love freedom. But in fact, one thing that surprises folks is to hear that not even Sam Houston wanted secession, that he stood out in San Pedro Park for hours and begged the people of Texas not to secede from the Union originally. And in fact, what a lot of people don't know, he was at the time governor of Texas, and he got booted out of the governorship for his anti-secession stance. So I think sometimes when people hear, wait a minute, Sam Houston didn't want secession, Sam Houston fought that.
Teresa Van Hoy is a history professor at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. She says there's no recognized legal mechanism that would allow Texas to break away from the Union, even if there's an internet petition on the White House website. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs online on our website at tpr.org. And you can download the free podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.